Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source, grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's useful to have some notebook, paper, and pen to take notes during this show. And I like to start with an important credit because the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of attorney, scholar, and author Ellen Brown, who has 11 books and scores of articles in publication. I highly recommend her book, The Web of Debt, and her website by the same name. And we are within a segment of this programming in which we are studying from the book, The Web of Debt, which we have been doing for some while now. In essence, this is about the shocking truth of our money system and how we can break free from its grip. There are a lot of myths and misconceptions about money, and as a recap, I start with the following. Our money system is not what we have been led to believe. The creation of money has been privatized or taken over by a private money cartel. Except for coins, all of our money is now created as loans advanced by private banking institutions, including the private Federal Reserve. Banks create the principal but not the interest to service their loans. To find the interest, new loans must continually be taken out, expanding the money supply, inflating prices, and robbing you of the value of your money. The Web of Debt, this book that we are investigating, unravels the deception and presents a crystal clear picture of the financial abyss towards which we are heading, both individually and socially. It explores a workable alternative, one that was tested in colonial America and is grounded in the best of American economic thought, including the writings of Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and Abraham Lincoln. And what we really care about is our financial security, our nation's, and our own. And that's why we're investigating how we can deal with the fundamental underlying conceptual mistake that has been made by our financial system to the detriment of the masses of the people. As I said, we have been investigating this topic for some weeks now. You can listen to past shows in the archives at www.kruufm.com under Life and Debt. Web is the specific series of shows related to this text. Again, just to emphasize the fact that even the government is borrowing money, it is in effect borrowing its own money from the Fed. And what we are paying on that is not even the principal anymore for the loan, which is a constant reality of borrowing, but the interest alone on that astronomical loan that is being taken. And briefly, a review of what we ended with during the last show, we actually brought up again the point of how the Wonderful Wizard of Oz is an allegory on the financial situation of America at the change of the century from the 19th century to the 20th century. And in past shows, we brought up the characters and what they represented. For example, the Scarecrow represented the farmers, the Tin Man represented the industrial workers. The Wicked Witch of the East, who was killed, represented Wall Street and the bankers. And the Wicked Witch of the West, who was really the Wicked Witch of the Midwest, who represented the McKinley-Rockefeller faction in Ohio, which, as I said, was then considered the West. So all these characters do represent what was happening in the financial world. And as for Dorothy, she really represented the mass of people in general who were innocent and beguiled by what was going on. So when the Wicked Witch of the West looked at her, what the Wicked Witch saw was the child's eyes and how simple the soul was behind them, and that she did not know of the wonderful power of the silver shoes that were given her. As I mentioned before, in the movie, it's ruby slippers, but in the book, it's actually silver shoes, which represent silver as a specie and silver notes backing dollars. And the silver was supposedly a very useful thing in the financial challenges of the new colonies and pre-revolution in the United States. So just as Dorothy did not know the power of the silver shoes on her feet, so the new country's leaders at the time of the revolution failed to recognize the power of the government-issued paper money, which Thomas Paine had called the cornerstone of the revolution. The economic subservience King George could not achieve by force during the revolution was achieved by the British bankers by stealth. And this is actually continuing to happen, and it's really the nub of our problem. Then it was persuading the American people that they needed the bankers' paper money instead of their own. This is precisely where we are today in the way we have constructed the economic system in America. President John Adams was quoted as saying, "There are two ways to conquer and enslave a nation. One is by sword, the other is by debt." Well, the conquest by sword has the obvious disadvantage that the conquered are likely to rebel. We see this historically all over the world. Continual force is required to keep them at bay. Yet, conquest by debt can occur so silently and insidiously that the conquered don't even realize that they have new masters. On the surface, nothing has changed. The country is merely under new management. And again, we're reviewing what happened at the time of the U.S. Revolution, or better said, I guess, the American Revolution. There is a tribute, and that is collected in the form of debts and taxes, which the people believe they are paying for their own good. Their captors become their benefactors and protectors. Without realizing it, they are conquered, and the instruments of their own society are used to transfer their wealth to their captors and make the conquest complete. And again, back then we're looking at British bankers, but the too big to fail rubric is no different today. It's interesting to note that colonies in the 16th and the 18th centuries all had the same purpose, to enhance the economy of the mother country. That was how the mother country saw it. But the American colonists had long opposed any plan that would systematically drain their money supply off to England. The British had considered the idea of a land bank as far back as 1754 as a way to provide a circulating medium of exchange for the colonies. But the idea was rejected by the colonists when they learned that the interest the bank generated would be subject to appropriation by the king. It wasn't coming back to the people. So it was only after the American Revolution that British bankers and their Wall Street vassals, at that time they were the vassals, succeeded in pulling this feat off by stealth, by acquiring a controlling interest in the stock of the new United States Bank. And I'll get back to the topic in a moment. If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now back to the conquest of the new American government by the British bankers and the Wall Street vassals. The first step in that silent conquest was to discredit the paper scrip issued by the revolutionary government and the states. By the end of the revolution, that step had already been achieved. They did it, as those who've listened in the past recall, by rampant counterfeiting and, of course, speculation, which thoroughly collapsed the value of the continental scrip that the new country's leaders were completely disillusioned with what they called unfunded paper, which means not backed by gold or silver. But the point I want to emphasize here is that it wasn't the fact that the money wasn't backed that was essentially the issue. It was, in the process, counterfeiting and speculation, which were intentional strategies to destroy the value of the money, the continental scrip. At the Constitutional Convention, Alexander Hamilton, who was Washington's new Secretary of the Treasury, summed up the majority view when he said, quote, "To omit an unfunded paper as the sign of value ought not to continue a formal part of the Constitution, nor ever hereafter to be employed, being in its nature repugnant with abuses and liable to be made the engine of imposition and fraud." That's an unfortunate statement, actually. While true on one hand, what emanated as a result was a situation where there is, in fact, more imposition and more fraud against the people through the banks. However, the Founding Fathers were so disillusioned with paper money that they simply omitted it from the Constitution. In the Constitution itself, Congress was given the power only to coin money, regulate the value thereof, and to borrow money on the credit of the United States. So we see an enormous loophole left in the law here. Creating and issuing money had long been considered the prerogative of governments, but the Constitution failed to define exactly what money was. Was to coin money an 18th century way of saying to create money? Did this include creating paper money? If not, who did have the power to create paper money? Congress was authorized to borrow money, but did that include borrowing paper money or just gold? The presumption was that paper notes borrowed from the bankers were secured by a sum of gold or silver. But in the illusory world of finance, then, as it certainly is now, things were not always as they seemed, which is what we're trying to educate ourselves about here. In a very polite way, I'm saying we're being duped, which frankly is no discredit to your intelligence. It's a fundamental paradigm that the entire nation was duped into by stealth and sleight of hand, by outright deception. Back to the Founding Fathers, they were pledging their faith in gold and silver as the only sound money. Those metals, however, at the same moment, were quickly proving inadequate to fund the new country's expanding economy. The national war debt had reached $42 million, with no silver or gold coins available to pay it off. That debt might have been avoided if the government had funded the war with continental scrip that was stamped legal tender, making it the money in itself. But the revolutionary government and the states had issued much of their paper money as promissory notes payable after the war. The notes represented debt, and the debt had now come due. The bearers expected to get their gold, and the gold was not to be had. There was also an insufficient supply of money for conducting trade. Tightening the money supply by limiting it to coins had quickly precipitated another depression. In 1786, a farmers' rebellion broke out in Massachusetts, with farmers brandishing pitchforks and complaining of going heavily into debt when paper money was plentiful. When it was no longer available and the debts had to be repaid in the much scarcer hard coin of the British bankers, some farmers lost their farms. The rebellion was diffused, but visions of anarchy solidified the sense of an urgent need for a strong central government and an expandable money supply. So this is really the economic birth of the nation. The solution of Treasury Secretary Hamilton was to monetize the national debt by turning it into a source of money for the country. As an aside, to monetize means to convert government debt from securities evidencing debt, such as bills, bonds, and notes, into currency that can be used to purchase goods and services. Back to Hamilton, he proposed that a national bank be authorized to print up banknotes and swap them for the government's bonds. The government would pay the regular interest on the debt using import duties and money from the sale of public land. Opponents said that acknowledging the government's debt at face value would unfairly reward the speculators who had bought up the country's IOUs for a pittance from the soldiers, farmers, and small businessmen who had actually earned them. But Hamilton argued that the speculators had earned this windfall for their faith in the country. He thought the government needed to enlist the support of speculators, or they would do to the new country's money what had been done to the Continental. Vernon Parrington, who was a historian writing in the 1920s, said, "In developing his policies as Secretary of the Treasury, Hamilton applied his favorite principle, that government and property must join in close working alliance. It was notorious that during the Revolution, men of wealth had forced down the Continental currency for speculative purposes. Was it not as certain that they would support an issue in which they were interested? The private resources of wealthy citizens would thus become an asset of government, for the bank would link the interests of the state in an intimate connection with those of the rich individuals belonging to it." In other words, what Hamilton thought was that the way to keep wealthy speculators from destroying the new national bank was to give them a financial stake in it. His proposal would do this and dispose of the government's crippling debts at the same time by allowing creditors to trade the government bonds or IOUs for stock in the new bank. Thomas Jefferson responded. He was Hamilton's chief political opponent, and he feared that giving private wealthy citizens an ownership interest in the bank would link their interests too closely with it. The government would be turned into an oligarchy, a government by the rich at war with the working classes. A bank owned by private stockholders whose driving motive was profit would be less likely to be responsive to the needs of the public than one that was owned by the public and subject to public oversight. Again, we should be seeing some parallels to what is existing nowadays. I want to repeat this point. A bank owned by private stockholders whose driving motive was profit would be less likely to be responsive to the needs of the public than one that was owned by the public and subject to public oversight. Stockholders of a private bank would make their financial decisions behind closed doors without public knowledge or control. And yet, the government was completely dependent on the bank. However, again, there are other issues at stake here, and Hamilton's plan had other strategic advantages, and it won the day. Besides neatly disposing of a crippling federal debt and winning over the men of wealth, it secured the loyalty of the individual states by making their debts, too, exchangeable for stock in the new bank. The move was controversial, but by stabilizing the state's shaky finances, Hamilton got the states on board, thwarting the plans of the pro-British faction that hoped to split them up and establish a Northern Confederacy. And we'll look at the American system versus the British system in a moment. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Alexander Hamilton's goal was first and foremost a strong federal government. He was the chief author of the Federalist Papers, which helped to get the votes necessary to ratify the Constitution and form the basis for much of it. The preamble of the Constitution made promoting the general welfare a guiding principle of the new republic. Hamilton's plan for achieving this ideal was to nurture the country's fledgling industries with protective measures such as tariffs, which are taxes placed on imports or exports, and easy credit provided through a national bank. Production and the money to finance it would all be kept in-house, independent of foreign financiers. Senator Henry Clay later called this the American system to distinguish it from the British system of free trade. And as a footnote, the term free trade is used to mean trade between nations unrestricted by such things as import duties and trade quotas. Critics say in more developed nations, it results in jobs being exported abroad, while in less developed nations, workers and the environment are exploited by foreign financiers. Again, that's free trade. Senator Clay was a student of Matthew Carey, who was a well-known printer and publisher, and who had been tutored by Benjamin Franklin. What Clay called the British system was rooted in the dog-eat-dog world of Thomas Hobbes, John Locke, and Scottish economist Adam Smith. Smith maintained in his 1776 book, The Wealth of Nations, that if every man pursued his own greed, all would automatically come out right, as if by some invisible hand. Proponents of the American system rejected this laissez-faire approach in favor of guiding and protecting the young country with a system of rules and regulations. They felt that if the economy were left to the free market, big monopolies would gobble up small entrepreneurs. Foreign bankers and industrialists could exploit the country's labor and materials, and competition would force prices down, ensuring subjugation to British imperial interests. Looking at the British model, it assumed that one man's gain could occur only through another's loss. The goal was to reach the top of the heap by climbing on competitors and driving them down. In the American vision of the Commonwealth, all men would rise together by leavening the whole heap at once. A republic of sovereign states would work together for their mutual benefit, improving their collective lot by promoting production, science, industry, and trade, raising the standard of living and the technological practice of all by cooperative effort. It was an idealistic reflection of the American dream, which assumed the best in people and in human potential. You did not need to exploit foreign lands and people in pursuit of free trade. Like Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz, you could find your heart's desire in your own backyard. Well, that was the vision, but in the sort of negotiated compromise that has long characterized politics, it got lost somewhere in the details. Alexander Hamilton argued that to promote the general welfare, the country needed a monetary system that was independent of foreign masters, and for that, it needed its own federal central bank. The bank would handle the government's enormous war debt and create a standard form of currency. In the background, Thomas Jefferson remained suspicious of Hamilton and his schemes, but Jefferson also felt strongly that the new country's capital city should be in the South, in his home state of Virginia. Hamilton, who did not care where the capital was, agreed on the location of the national capital in exchange for Jefferson's agreement on the bank, which historically may have been a big blunder. In other words, not a fair arm's length exchange going on here. When Hamilton called for a tax on whiskey to pay the interest on the government's securities, he was seen to have gone too far. Jefferson's supporters were furious. In the type of political compromise still popular today, President Washington proposed moving the capital even closer to Mount Vernon. In 1789, Congress passed Hamilton's bill, but the president still had to sign it. Washington was concerned that the continued opposition of Jefferson and the Virginians, who thought the bill was unconstitutional, still had to be contended with. The public would have to use the bank, but the bank would not have to serve the public. Hamilton assured the president that to protect the public, the bank would be required to retain a percentage of gold in reserve so that it could redeem its paper notes in gold or silver on demand. And for those of you who have heard this before, this takes us back to the goldsmiths in England, where the birth of the fractional reserve system took place. Well, Hamilton was exceedingly eloquent, and in 1791, Washington signed the bill into law. Now we had this new banking scheme, and it was hailed as a brilliant solution to the nation's economic straits, one that disposed of an oppressive national debt, stabilized the economy, funded the government's budget, and created confidence in the new paper dollars. If the new Congress had simply printed its own paper money, speculators would have challenged the currency's worth and driven down its value, just as they had during the Revolution. To maintain public confidence in the national currency and establish its stability, the new republic needed the illusion that its dollars were backed by the banker's gold, and Hamilton's bank successfully met that challenge. The same grand illusion we're operating under today. It got the country up and running, but it left the bank largely in private hands, where it could be manipulated for private greed. Worse, the government ended up in debt for money it could have generated itself, indeed, should have generated itself under the U.S. Constitution. The charter for this new bank fixed its total initial capitalization at $10 million. $8 million were to come from private stockholders and $2 million from the government. But the government did not actually have $2 million, so the bank, now a chartered lending institution, lent the government the money at interest. The bank, of course, did not have the money either, so the whole thing was a massive sleight of hand. The rest of the bank's shares were sold to the public, who bought some in hard cash and some in government securities. Those are the IOUs that had been issued by the revolutionary government in the states. The government had to pay 6% interest annually on all the securities now held by the bank, those exchanged for the loan of the government's own money, plus the bonds accepted by the bank from the public. The bank's shareholders were supposed to pay 1/4 of the cost of the shares in gold, but only the first installment was actually paid in hard money, totaling $675,000. The rest was paid in paper banknotes. Some came from the Bank of Boston and the Bank of New York, but most of this paper money was issued by the new U.S. bank itself and lent back to its new shareholders through the magic of fractional reserve lending. Again, fractional reserve lending is, simply put, giving out in loans a large amount of money in relationship to a very small amount, which is held in reserve in specie in the form of gold or silver. So the magic commenced in a major way in America. Within 5 years, the government had borrowed $8.2 million from the bank. The additional money was obviously created out of thin air, just as it would have been if the government had printed the money itself. But, and this is the catch, the government now owed principal and interest back to the bank. To reduce its debt to the bank, the government was eventually forced to sell its shares. And where did they go? Largely to British financiers. At that point, it was reported that Hamilton opposed these sales, but the sales went through, and the First Bank of the United States wound up largely under foreign ownership and control. And next week, I will continue with moving from matriarchies of abundance to patriarchies of debt. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life in Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from QLP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.